We will call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order, and we can go ahead and roll the tape whenever you're ready. Representative Hackbarth, are you ready? We do not have a quorum right now, but we're going to go ahead and start testimony on the bill. And when we get a quorum, then we will make it official. Representative Stensrud, would you like to move this bill for Representative Hackbarth, House File 664?
Yeah. So moved.
Representative Stensrud moves House File 664, so it is before us. Representative Hackbarth, welcome to the committee, and please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I was here last week, and you guys did a good job for me, and I'm looking forward to it again today. Members, this is a bill that was brought to me by a constituent. Actually, I don't believe I have an elevator in my district, but a constituent of mine does own some condominiums and apartment buildings, and he does have some elevators. And this issue was brought to me by him with the concern that they did an inspection, and he needs to comply with this new law that we passed. And the deadline for that is January of next year, 2012. And it puts quite a burden on some of these older condominium homeowners, and it's very, very expensive to bring these elevators up to date. And simply what this bill does is extend out the date for compliance. And with me today, I have a gentleman that will explain the bill a little bit further and what the problems are that we're facing.
Sounds good, Representative Hackbarth. Sir, identify yourself for the record and proceed whenever you're ready.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Todd Lilgenquist. I'm with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, trade association for the rental housing industry of property, property owners, managers of rental housing. I'm here to speak on behalf of a group. The groups involved in this, of course, is the Department of Labor and Industry. We've been meeting with them, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minneapolis and St. Paul, BOMA, Alina Hospitals and Clinics, and Aging Services of Minnesota. And as Representative Hackbarth explained, this bill, certain elevator upgrades become effective January 29th, 2012. And what this bill would do is provide a little relief for property owners seeking to comply with those requirements to actually comply. And what it does is allow a property owner to submit what's called a compliance plan and implement that plan over that three-year period, subject to approval by the Department of Labor and Industry. And the reasons that we believe this bill is necessary, the rules were adopted in 07, and obviously since 07 we've seen an economic climate unlike any some of us have seen in our lifetime. So the economic climate has changed for many of us, as well as the owners seeking to comply with this. In addition, limited contractor availability. There are a finite number of contractors who can actually do this elevator upgrade work. So we're dealing with some issues related to that. And even if everybody were to seek compliance, there just aren't enough contractors available. We did an informal poll in our membership and polled all of our members, or a large number of our members, and they emailed back, and 119 elevators were indicated in this response. And of those 119, and this was sent out in December, only 48 had complied. So that means 71, and that's just our membership. This applies not only residential but also commercial elevators. We just don't believe that there's time and availability of contractors to complete the required work.
Thank you, sir. Representative Hackbarth?
And Mr. Chairman, it's not only a contractor issue of trying to comply and getting these things repaired, but also it's an inspector issue, too. City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul don't have enough inspectors to go out and get these all even inspected by the allotted amount of time. So this is going to give them some extra time to get out and get all the elevators inspected also, and also with the Department of Labor and their inspectors to do it statewide and get all the elevators inspected.
Thank you. Members, any questions?
I should add, too, Mr. Chairman, that this is not a department bill, but this is a bill that we worked on the department with putting the bill together.
Okay. Seeing no questions, is there anyone in the audience that wants to come down and testify for or against this bill? I'm not aware of any opposition. No one contacted us to testify. So seeing no one, with that, Representative Stensrud renews his motion that House File 664 be passed and sent on to the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We appreciate
Thank you, members.
Have a good day. Representative Beard. And while we're waiting for Representative Beard to come up, now that we have a quorum, we will go ahead and have Representative Dowd, if you would be so kind as to move the minutes. We will approve the minutes from last time.
I would be honored, Mr. Chairman. I'd move the minutes.
Thank you. Those in favor of approving Representative Dowd's motion to approve the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. And I just want to let anybody in the audience know, just in case people don't, we're departing a little bit from our original agenda. House File 441, Representative Loon's bill dealing with prepaid wireless services and 911 fees has been moved from the agenda. Will we hear that at a later date? We're not going to hear it today, so I don't see anybody running from the room, but just in case anybody was waiting for that one, we're not going to do it. We're going to proceed to House File 572, Representative Beard, and also we will be hearing testimony in the Beard bill. We will not be voting on this bill until next Tuesday, but we are going to hear testimony today, and we will lay the bill over and vote on it next Tuesday. Representative Anderson, if you would move House File 572, House File 72 for Representative Beard, so it's before us. We will proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that move House File number 72.
And we are moving this on to the General Register, I believe.
Please.
Representative Beard, welcome to the committee. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, it's good to be here and to be in front of the Commerce Committee this afternoon, because we're going to talk about commerce, Minnesota-based commerce, providing abundant, steady, and affordable baseload electrical generation that all Minnesotans can benefit from in their private lives, in their businesses, and in their jobs. House File 72 proposes to repeal a section of law that was passed in 2007, Senate File 145, also known as the Next Generation Act. The bill that I'm proposing would lift a virtual moratorium that prevents Minnesota utilities from importing electrical energy that's generated outside the state of Minnesota if that power was generated by coal. Even worse, it prohibits any Minnesota utility from considering building new baseload facility in this state if it would be fueled by coal, no matter how clean or how cutting edge the technology for cleaning the emissions might be. Members, you heard me correctly. No new industrial tax base, no new high-paying jobs if they're connected to a new power plant that is fired by coal, no matter how clean the technology might be. Now, the Next Gen Act of 2007 only addresses intermittent energy and energy efficiency. It does nothing to address our baseload energy needs. The Next Gen Act did not do enough, I believe, to encourage clean energy, particularly in the baseload mode. In fact, I think you'll find it discourages clean energy technology from being applied to our most abundant domestic fuel resource, coal. My contention is that we need all energy sources to keep our economy rolling. Not just renewables, not just natural gas, but all energy sources. But the Next Gen Act depends only on fuels that are not quite ready for prime time, certainly not baseload quality, and they probably won't be ready for prime time or baseload needs before our next round of baseload power plants are needed to be built, either through increased economic expansion or through the need to replace some of our aging fleet. Folks, we need balance. We need a balanced approach. We need reliable, affordable baseload energy that's as clean as possible from all sources, including the source that our friends in Montana, Wyoming, and North Dakota can provide us, coal. If alternative energies are to develop without wrecking our economy, we need a robust, reliable, and affordable system of baseload power in order to make that possible. In our grid right now, we're running out of margins that will be even tighter when the economy begins to pick up again. We will be buying off the grid, or expecting our utilities to do so, and folks, that is a very expensive proposition. I'm asking for your support for House File 72. The Next Gen Act of 2007, combined with the Great Recession of 2009-2010, which we hope we're coming out of now, is driving up costs to the ratepayers, casting a chilling effect over major investment opportunities in our own state, and placing our future reliability of our electric grid in some doubt. House File 72 would remove what I believe to be an insult to our neighboring states, particularly our friends in North Dakota, remove a serious impediment to interstate commerce, which is one reason we're in front of this committee. And it's commerce that's so important to jobs and prosperity in our state and in our region, because, folks, they're our cousins. This is our region. We're all connected. Members, if we want real jobs, high-paying, living-wage-type jobs that power plants provide, and we want them here in Minnesota and not in Nebraska and North Dakota, then we need a balanced approach to energy production. Don't demand of renewables things that they cannot deliver. That's just not fair to emerging technologies. We need abundant, affordable, reliable Minnesota-based load power, and we need it from all sources. Members, I ask for your support on House File 72.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Members, any questions for the author? Representative Anzos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I assume that these good jobs are going to be union jobs, right?
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to think of a single power plant in this state that is not IBEW-based, and whenever they're built, they're usually built with project labor agreements by the unions that I favor most, the trade unions. You know I'm not a big union guy, but I do respect and admire the people who put their lives into dedicating themselves to learning a craft, a trade, apprenticing, and becoming journeymen. Those are the people that build the power plants in this state. And so, yes, you can probably count on that happening, Representative Ansel.
Very good.
Thank you. Any other questions, members?
Just one quick one, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
For a second, I thought I was on the wrong bill. You said it's a coal moratorium, Representative Beard. I was looking in the actual language to see if there was, and I'm not on the Energy Committee with you and all of that or whatever, but there's not really a moratorium, right?
Representative Beard.
Thank you for the question, Representative Atkins and Mr. Chairman. It's what I call a virtual moratorium. The way the language is written, if you'll give me just a second here, I'll pull it up in front of myself again. You'll notice that there is a prohibition against building facilities unless they do one of three things. Well, actually, building a facility in a state that's considered a large energy facility, importing power from a new facility outside the state, that's sort of the situation some of our co-ops find themselves in right now, or expanding or renewing a power purchase agreement that increases the importation of coal-fired electricity in the state, unless they do some things. One of which is they could buy carbon offsets in a carbon climate exchange somewhere. Now, members, I'll point out that that's problematic in several areas. One of them is the economics. Why would we buy power from outside the state and then pay twice for it by sending money to one of the two climate exchanges that I'm familiar with that still exist, I believe, California or Massachusetts, the Northeast Compact or the Western Climate Initiative? The Chicago Climate Exchange, which, oh, by the way, existed when this bill was drafted, and I think the anticipation was people would flock to Chicago and buy carbon credits on the exchange down there that was controlled by a certain former vice president. That has gone bankrupt. I believe it's bankrupted. Nonetheless, to be sure, it is gone. They ceased operations because the market evaporated. The other thing they could do is they could demonstrate to the Public Utility Commission that they have kind of mitigated their impact of their carbon footprint. This is problematic in that that's, and you're going to get to this question in a moment, I'm sure, what changed, what happened with the so-called off-ramps, for instance. One of the off-ramps was the PUC could find that the company importing the power or building a plant in this state could actually mitigate the carbon effects, carbon dioxide, if you're concerned about those things. In this case, one of the companies that we have that is having a problem has gone to the PUC. They didn't have the foresight to get an exemption in the original bill. They figured they could mitigate their problem and explain it to PUC, and PUC would say, nice job, pat them on the head, and give them the authority to import power from a new power plant that has just now been completed in North Dakota. Instead, the PUC looked at our off-ramps and said, this is frankly rather poorly written legislation. We don't understand what this means. The off-ramps and the ability for them to mitigate by doing things like, say, cogeneration with Cargill, by drying their lignite and reducing their carbon and nitrogen and sulfur emissions dramatically, and by doing some other things to kind of mitigate the carbon dioxide process, have been completely unclear to the PUC, and the PUC is completely baffled as to how to apply that. Apparently, what I do know for certain is that last week they said that this would be now a contested hearing, punted it to an administrative law judge. At a minimum, that will take at least 1 year to adjudicate, probably more. And so the outcome of going through the off-ramps and trying to accomplish what the original next-gen Act tried to put into play has come completely off the rails, Representative Atkins, and so it's completely unclear as to how in the world anybody could comply. So when I say it's a virtual moratorium, it's a virtual moratorium.
Representative Atkins, did that answer your question? I got lost after the reference to. I was lost after the reference to former Vice President Cheney.
I don't precisely know what Representative Beard said. I couldn't even tell you at this point, Representative Beard, if that was a yes or a no. But it sounded good. But it sure was it was thoughtful.
It had
many monos, polysyllabic words in it and all of that, and that was good. So maybe we'll be better off with some testimony, and then we'll go from there.
And Representative Beard, do you have people that you want to testify in favor of the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, there are several who have asked to testify in favor of the bill, yes.
Okay.
I think that they are ready to come forward and say a few words now.
We have Mike Jones as the first person on the list. He is here and would like to come forward. Mr. Jones, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today and share some of my thoughts. My name is Dr. Mike Jones. I hold the position of Vice President of Research and Development for the Lignite Energy Council and also serve as Director and Technical Representative for the State of North Dakota's Lignite Research Development and Marketing Program. My PhD is in physics from the University of North Dakota. I worked for 30 years with the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. My career was focused on research and development of clean and efficient energy technology systems so the Upper Midwest residents and businesses can make use of the abundant coal resources of our state and country. The Lignite Energy Council is a regional trade association representing lignite producers who sell about 30 million tons of lignite annually. Utilities which generate affordable, reliable electricity for 2 million people in our region, and businesses that provide goods and services accounting for nearly $3 billion in gross business volume. As you all know, an ample supply of affordable energy is crucial to the economic growth of any state. North Dakota's lignite industry provides electricity to customers in more than two-thirds of Minnesota. Much of this territory is served by rural and suburban electric distribution cooperatives and municipal utilities. It is important to note that North Dakota delivers low-cost, reliable electricity from lignite, and we also do it in a manner that is compatible with federal environmental standards. The owners of the power plants have also invested approximately $1.7 billion in emission control technologies to reduce pollutants regulated by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. The result is that North Dakota is one of only 12 states in the nation, along with Minnesota, that meets all of the federal ambient air quality standards. We also consistently receive an A grade from the American Lung Association for our air quality. The state of North Dakota is an active financial partner with the lignite industry in research and development projects to further reduce emissions and improve efficiencies. The money invested by the state comes from tax collected on every ton of lignite mined. Since 1987, the state of North Dakota has invested more than $60 million in 150-plus lignite research and development projects, totaling a value of more than $570 million. Currently, the state has leveraged over $8 million to support over $180 million in projects to advance technologies to capture and store carbon dioxide from power plants. The largest R&D project is called the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership, or PCORP. This is one of seven regional partnerships that is partially funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. Many of the Lignite Energy Council's members, along with the state of North Dakota, are involved with PCORP, which is working to identify, quantify, and determine the technical feasibility and economic costs associated with various CO2 storage technologies, and operates in 9 Midwestern states and 3 Canadian provinces. North Dakota is also home to the world's largest carbon capture project. The Great Plains Synthetic Fuels Plant uses gasification technology to make synthetic natural gas from lignite. Approximately 8,500 tons of CO2 per day are captured and sold to Canadian oil firms. The gas is used for enhanced oil recovery in partially depleted oil fields near Weyburn, Saskatchewan. While this technology used for the in the synthetic fuels plant and that used in power plants are substantially different, the lignite industry has existing infrastructure which can be used to move CO2 once it can be economically captured from its power plants. In addition, an $80,000 investment by the state has resulted in the sale of almost all the fly ash that is produced by Great River Energy's Coal Creek Station. What once was a waste product is now sold as a replacement for Portland cement and is used in making a very durable concrete product. In fact, that fly ash from North Dakota was used in rebuilding the I-35 bridge, which of course collapsed here in the city of Minneapolis not long ago. This resulted in the savings of 1 ton of CO2 for every ton of Portland cement since it was replaced by fly ash. The benefits to Minnesota from the regional lignite industry include access to low-cost, reliable electricity that's good for job creation in all corners of the state. There are also more than 70 Minnesota companies that provide direct goods and services to the mines and plants. Some provide the labor required for scheduled outages to clean boilers, rewire turbines, and paint the exteriors of equipment and plants. Others provide materials such as conveyors, instrumentation, and fire protection systems. Often these same companies sell the products and services to Minnesota utilities or mining companies, resulting in more regional economic activity. We believe the energy partnership between the lignite industry and the state of Minnesota has been mutually rewarding. It makes sense for Minnesota to continue this energy partnership that not only meets the customer's needs, but allows your state to be among the industry leaders in investing, researching, and developing better technologies that result in reduced emissions, increased efficiency, and the power needed to build a stronger Minnesota economy. On behalf of the members of the Lignite Energy Council, we encourage you to pass this legislation and continue this energy partnership between our states. I want to thank you for your time and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, with regard to the labor climate in North Dakota, is North Dakota a merit shop or closed shop state?
I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer that directly. I do know that in the lignite fields, both the miners and the plants are all union, and most of the workers in those plants do are union members, but that's all I can speak to on that.
Thank you. Anzels, Representative Anzels.
Thank you for that. Then would you know offhand if North Dakota is a right-to-work state?
Again, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm a scientist, and that's not my area of expertise.
Well, you're talking about the economy and economic benefits, and I'm just trying to get a handle on that.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, what did you say they do with the CO2?
Dr. Jones.
What happens is the CO2 is a byproduct of the formation of methane, which is natural gas. And so that's separated, and then it's compressed and travels by pipeline a little over 200 miles up into the oil fields in Weyburn, Saskatchewan. And it's used for enhanced oil recovery, if you're familiar with that. Basically what they do is they repressurize an oil field and it allows for significant more oil to be produced. And certainly I can get you data on how much of that. I don't have those figures on the top of my head.
Well, Representative Mueller.
Chairman, Doctor, I thought I had read some articles in the last year that there were some problems from that, that it was causing problems with fissures into the water or if it was secondary leakage into the air. That whole idea of, in fact, I think isn't the Indiana or Ohio experimental plant doing something like that and they're not having great results?
Dr. Jones.
There are a number of demonstrations. One of the goals of the regional partnerships is to look at the technical and economic feasibility of what we refer to as geologic sequestration, and that's what we're talking about here. I don't know about the Indiana. I can speak a little bit to what I've read, since I'm not directly involved in the Weyburn fields. There was reports that there was some leakage that had been noted by a farmer or in the area above where the CO2 was being stored. The latest things that I saw that came out of a large international group indicated that they did not see any connection with that CO2 and the CO2 that was being stored, that they felt that was from natural sources. And I can send you some of the information from that group. But again, I'm not a geoscientist. I'm a physicist, and so I'm not an expert in all of those phenomena that are occurring underground. But I'd be happy to share some of the reports that I have seen in that area.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Other questions, members? Otherwise, we'll get Mr. Olson up here from Great River. Thank you, Doctor. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed whenever you are ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Olson, and I am the Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy. For those of you who don't know Great River Energy, we are a generation and transmission electric cooperative headquartered in Maple Grove. We serve and are owned by 28 Minnesota Electric Distribution Cooperatives, who in turn serve member consumers who make up about a third of Minnesota's population and about two-thirds of Minnesota's geographic area. I am here to express on behalf of Great River Energy support for the passage of House File 72. Although the economic downturn has slowed growth in the use of electricity, that could turn around in a very short time, and Minnesota would need cost-effective baseload generation. Why would we want to prohibit what might be the best option at the time that we need more power? We at GRE believe that regulation of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's really what this part of the Next Generation Energy Act is, it's about greenhouse gas emissions. We believe that's a national issue that should be handled at the national level. We also think that the very stringent federal regulation of coal plants has made coal-fired electricity very clean, and pending and proposed federal regulations will make coal even cleaner. Minnesota receives over 50% of its electric energy from coal-fired power plants. Electric energy from coal plants provides the economic foundation for the affordable electric rates enjoyed by Minnesota families and businesses. Minnesota should not go it alone in placing severe restrictions on coal plants. Why increase costs and put Minnesota's competitiveness at risk with no benefit in return when other states have not followed suit? The existing statute has created several issues that make determining how to plan for complying with it impossible. The statute's general exemption provision exempts only plants that are, quote, essential, an impossible standard to meet. Another significant issue relates to the statutory provision that allows utilities to offset CO2 emission reductions from existing facilities against the CO2 emissions from new plants that are subject to the statute. As has been discussed, Great River Energy is in the very early stages of a proceeding at the Minnesota PUC regarding our plan to offset emissions at our new Spiritwood Station coal-fired combined heat and power plant near Jamestown, North Dakota. Construction of Spiritwood is complete, and we expect it to go online January 1st of next year. Spiritwood is a 99-megawatt plant that will generate electricity, but will also produce steam to provide the energy needs for Cargill's adjacent malting facility under a 30-year contract. Spiritwood is a state-of-the-art facility built during the recession with the help of Minnesota contractors and many Minnesota workers. When Spiritwood's steam capacity is fully subscribed, it will emit CO2 at about the same rate as a gas-fired peaking plant, which plants are exempt from the statute. In addition, because Spiritwood uses best available pollution control technology, it will have very low emissions. It will be the cleanest coal plant around. Great River Energy has reduced our CO2 emissions from other facilities by an amount that is more than sufficient to offset CO2 emissions from Spiritwood. We expected we would be able to use these offsets when we chose to go forward with Spiritwood after the statute was passed in 2007. But no one can agree on what the statute's confusing offset provisions mean. So the PUC has referred the matter to a contested case hearing. It is possible that the statute's offset provisions will be interpreted in a way that makes it all but impossible for common sense offsets to qualify. We expect resolution of the case will take more than a year and may not be resolved until the case is heard by appellate courts. If Great River Energy's offset plan isn't approved, we will have to purchase CO2 allowances from the regional CO2 markets in the Northeast or California. What's worse is we have no idea how much the CO2 allowances will cost during the years that we need to purchase them. The total cost to Minnesota Electric Co-op member consumers could rise to as much as $20 million per year from that. Great River Energy believes that such a wealth transfer from Minnesotans to other states makes no sense and has no benefit. For all the foregoing reasons, Great River Energy supports the passage of House File 72. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Members, any questions? If not, we will call up Mr. Grant. Mr. Grant, I don't know if you want to start first or Ms. O'Connell, whatever, whenever you guys want, whenever you're ready, please identify yourselves for the record and fire away. And welcome to the committee, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce, Office of Energy Security, and I have with me this afternoon Kate O'Connell, who is our manager of energy planning and advocacy, and we're going to tag team this a little bit. What we want to cover this afternoon are the issues related to House File 72 in terms of the need for this legislation, the cost of new coal, and the jobs associated with the path that we're on in terms of clean energy, the same issues that were addressed in the legislation that we're talking about, the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007, and the prospect for jobs from new coal plants. I want to start by reminding the committee that the Next Generation Energy Bill enjoyed broad bipartisan support. In this body alone, the bill passed 124-9 and was signed by Governor Pawlenty, setting in motion a fair amount of activity, including the formation of a Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group and a regional initiative that Governor Pawlenty spearheaded to establish a greenhouse gas reduction accord in cooperation with other states in the region. Minnesota Statute 216H03, the provision that we're discussing this afternoon, the subject of House File 72, was really the linchpin to achieving final agreement among bill conferees, which House File 72 now seeks to undo. And the reason that's true is that the emissions associated with coal plants are on their own large enough to undo progress that we would otherwise be making in pursuit of our renewable energy goals, our energy efficiency goals. A single coal plant can undo and reverse positive trends toward reducing greenhouse gas emissions as the Next Generation Energy Act called for. Let me start with the question of need for coal-fired electricity generally. Minnesota utility integrated resource plans show no need for baseload capacity through the year 2024. In the meantime, baseload power, to the extent that it is needed, will come from a variety of options that we're already pursuing, including uprates of two existing nuclear power plants, new hydroelectricity from Canada, and a combination of gas, wind, and energy efficiency that can, in many circumstances, mimic baseload capacity when combined. That particular combination, gas, wind, energy efficiency, is less expensive, requiring shorter lead times for construction and permitting, more modular operations, and is certainly less controversial than siting and building new coal plants. Second issue relative to new coal is its cost. It's not surprising that no Minnesota utilities are proposing to build new coal plants, not either here or nationally. Proposed coal plants have been canceled in record numbers across the country. And this isn't as much a matter of preferring one resource to another. This is simply a question of whether investors are willing to take the risk of investing in new coal. And investors across the country are saying no because the expected future costs and environmental liabilities associated with new coal are simply too high given the fact that we have other options available. New coal plants like integrated gasification combined cycle, which was the proposal of the Excelsior Energy plant here in Minnesota, would be projected to cost in the neighborhood of $3.5 billion for a 1,000 megawatt plant. Compare that to new natural gas combined cycle at about $1 billion. And energy efficiency, it would be difficult to compare it on a full plant size, but we've brought in the bulk of energy efficiency at less than 2 cents a kilowatt hour. Compare that to the current retail rate of electricity at somewhere between 8 and 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Coal is, as I mentioned, really receding nationally as a fuel of choice amongst electric utilities. Construction and fuel costs have been rising rapidly. As I mentioned, industry and investor uncertainty around federal clean air and climate regulations has really chilled the environment for new coal. But more importantly, the alternatives are simply faster and cheaper than struggling ahead with large new coal additions. Wanted to touch for a moment on the exemptions that are possible under the existing legislation. And I think, unless you understand the full breadth of those, it's hard to understand that this bill, the Next Generation Energy Bill, was not a coal moratorium. It does place restrictions on construction of new coal, but these restrictions are reasonable. And if you have the bill summary prepared by your research staff, I can just quickly walk you through those. First of all, there's an exemption for plants fueled primarily by natural gas. Secondly, and importantly, relative to the testimony that you heard from the Lignite Energy Council, plants that inject carbon dioxide emissions underground to prevent their release are exempted from the requirements of the Next Generation Energy Act. Plants that offset their greenhouse gas emissions by reducing emissions at an existing plant or purchasing carbon dioxide allowances can be exempt, and I'll have more on that at a moment since the issue of has come up about the case in front of the Public Utilities Commission right now. And then plants either built in Minnesota or outside the state through purchases can be approved if the Public Utilities Commission finds them essential for purposes of reliability, cost, or other reasons. I should point out to you that that standard is more or less the same standard that a new coal plant would need to meet under the state's existing Certificate of Need statute. This is not an impossible standard to meet, but it is a standard that's wisely been put in place to assure that we don't build unneeded capacity of any kind in Minnesota. Finally, I want to, before turning it to Ms. O'Connell, touch on the issue at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, because I think it's important to understand where that case is right now. And that issue is pending at the Public Utilities Commission, as the author and Mr. Olson pointed out, and the Next Generation Energy Act did allow for new coal to be imported into the state if qualifying offsets could be identified. It's of course true that the current offset market is depressed, and that it may be difficult to find qualifying offsets from market-based systems like the Chicago Climate Exchange was. However, what Great River Energy has proposed are three offset options that our department and other parties have found to be wanting under various provisions of the statute. The issue that has sent this matter to an administrative law judge for further discussion is the issue in the statute that said that offsets need to be those activities that would not have otherwise occurred. And this is the nub of the issue at the PUC and now in front of an ALJ. And I want to make it clear that I think the 2007 legislature put that requirement in place for a very good reason, and that is to prevent a company from simply offering some existing activity as a carbon offset rather than actually reducing their emissions through new activities. This is the essential meaning of would not have otherwise occurred. Frankly, I was surprised to see this matter referred to the ALJ because it's a fairly straightforward matter of first impression kind of a case. However, we are going to go through that issue in front of an administrative law judge. I don't believe it'll take anywhere near a year, but I think it's an important issue to resolve because if we are serious about meeting the goals the Next Generation Energy Act laid out, making sure that we are actually reducing carbon emissions as we move forward is critical to that progress. Otherwise, it really makes something of a farce of the Next Gen Act. With that, I'm going to turn it to Ms. O'Connell unless there are questions for me first. Mr.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, I heard you say that no investor-owned utility resource plan indicates a need for additional base load until 2024.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
How often are these resource plans to somebody like me, appear to be some in the closet, clandestine, you got to have eye shades on to figure out what is in these things and what the rationale is for what is said in these resource plans. Can these resource plans be amended at will or changed or lengthened, shortened?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anzac, we actually, the integrated resource planning process is an iterative process. We receive a new plan from each of our large utilities every 2 years. And the commission reviews those plans and issues orders as a result of those plans. They really are quite simple. I mean, I realize they get into a lot of complex detail, but at its most simple, the utilities forecast their future demand for meeting electric power needs with their customers, looking at all of the scenarios, both a high growth scenario and a low growth scenario and a medium growth scenario, and then look at the available generating and demand side resources, i.e. energy efficiency, that the utility has to meet those future load obligations. And we go through that process every 2 years to make sure that trends aren't changing more rapidly than we thought they were, that an economic recovery, for example, isn't moving a new need for new facilities up more quickly than what we had thought. And so this is something that we're doing. We're in the midst of a resource plan with the utility nearly all the time. And so,
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You heard my question before. It seems like every time we try to do anything except maybe wind, solar, and water or something, some evil genie pops out of the urn every time we try a different method. The first question is, can you answer the one I had about the escape and leakage of, I think there was an Indiana plant that supposedly had fixed it, and I think it's been online about a year, I'm not sure. But I know there was something about that, and I just can't remember. But on the other side, you mentioned using natural gas, and I know there's new studies showing that some of the ways of pressurizing to get that out is turning out to be environmental horror, too. So can you briefly explain some of those?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mullery, I'm fond of saying that in the energy world, there's no free lunch. And it's true of nearly any energy resource that you'd care to look at. They all have their warts. Carbon capture and storage, or carbon sequestration, by its more technical name, is a developing technology. We've stored gaseous materials underground for a long time, and storing carbon dioxide underground shouldn't be a huge technological hurdle. We need to find the appropriate geology in order to do that, and we need to make sure that we have a regulatory process in place to guard against leaks and to make sure that liability is assigned in the event that there are leaks. I think that if we meet again in 10 years, carbon capture and storage technology will be significantly further along than it is today, and that we may be seeing some of the first commercial scale projects beginning to come online. It, however, is a very expensive technology, at least in its current form, in part because it requires so much energy to compress the natural gas and then to move it underground. With such a large energy penalty comes a reduction in efficiency of the overall operation, and until that really improves, I don't know that we're going to see a lot of development at the utility scale. There's going to continue to be a lot of research in this area. The federal government is putting a lot of money into understanding this technology and developing it, but we're not ready to put it on the ground yet. With natural gas, I think you're referring to hydrofracking, which is the new technology for pressurizing depleted gas fields and moving gas to the wellhead. Principally in shale deposits around the country, it's exciting in the sense that it opens up huge domestic resources potentially. However, it requires vast amounts of water to be pumped underground, and when the water returns, it's not potable as it might have been when it went underground. And in fact, it may be fairly chemical laden, and there are disposal issues. So you've got both a water usage issue, a depletion of available water, and a water contamination issue potentially. Whether those issues can be resolved to allow this technology to really revolutionize domestic gas exploration and recovery, I think only time will tell. In the meantime, though, the availability of the technology has reduced gas prices substantially, and that's been our forecast out into the medium term, that this has opened up new gas supplies in a very significant way.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Other questions, members? That will move on to Ms. O'Connell.
Just one,
Representative
Chairman, Mr. Grant, I'll admit I was kind of skeptical of this whole greenhouse gas climate change stuff back in 2007, but the Governor Pawlenty was awfully persuasive back then in sort of spearheading the effort to pass the law. And I Admittedly, I kind of took his lead. I figured if this is one of those things where Democrats and Republicans are actually falling into line in agreement on it, you know, I'm no scientist, far be it from me to question that, and he's a smart fella. But my question to you is relative to the department's position. Governor Plenty, even just 60 days ago, was still governor. Was there any different direction from the governor? I assume he still supports the existing law. It passed whatever it was, 125-9 or something. But I invited Governor Plenty to join us in testifying today. Didn't hear anything from him, so my assumption is that he still supports the law. Have you heard anything different from the governor or from the current governor?
Representative Atkins, we're glad that you're on board with Governor Plenty, his position on this. This is what we call a first step. Now we're going to work on tax policy. We'll work on that. Mr. Grant?
Well, he was great for taxes and fees. Everything came out of the same pocket. So, but Mr. Grant?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, with respect to Governor Plenty, you know, I think we saw a rather significant reversal of his position on this issue while he was in office. I don't think he waited to leave office to for us to see that, and that you know, that was evident with a number of activities, but primarily through his at one point lack of continued leadership on the regional initiative and on the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, and making sure that those initiatives were in fact adopted. As far as Governor Dayton is concerned, he's very supportive of the Next Generation Energy Act. I don't believe he's taken a position on this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you, Chairman, Representatives. My name is Kate O'Connell, and I'll try to be brief, but there are some things that I want to make sure that you're aware of as you look at this important issue. First, there were a couple references to the issue that was sent to a contested case for Great River Energy and deciding what carbon offset meant and saying that it'll take at least a year. I do want to say that the commission actually pushed us really hard, pushed all the parties hard to make sure that the proceeding could get done as quickly as possible so that a decision would be made before the end of the year, so in time for Great River Energy to make its decision. So I just want to make sure that was out there. I do want to note, too, that Minnesota statutes, actually 216B sets out, I think very wisely, Minnesota's energy policy. It requires utilities to provide reliable service. It requires utilities to provide reasonable price service. It requires utilities to maintain certain levels of conservation. And it requires utilities to use renewable power unless it is not in the public interest to do so. So the policy benefits of Minnesota law are very important because they balance environmental objectives with the critical goals of ensuring that electric service is reliable and reasonably priced. And those sound like those might be conflicting goals, and sometimes they have been. But what my group of analysts have been seeing when we look at the resource plans is that those goals actually have been going in concert with each other. In other words, it is the least cost option to pursue additional wind. It is the least cost option to pursue additional energy efficiency. We were surprised when we first saw it, but the more we thought about it, the more it made sense. When you're looking at having to add huge chunks of energy, such as a baseload coal plant, that's very, very expensive to do. It's also very expensive when there are risks, when there are questions about who will pay for the carbon costs. Will it be shareholders? Will it be ratepayers? Will it be those who are lending money? That kind of risk and that kind of uncertainty makes baseload facilities look very difficult to support. It's much better to add small amounts of energy over time when our demand for energy is growing small in small increments, as it has been for the last decade or so. What we're seeing as we apply Minnesota statutes and looking at resource plans is that we're creating real jobs now and into the future. We're using our existing resources wisely. We're expanding Minnesota's existing nuclear resources. We're expanding Minnesota's renewable resources cost-effectively. We're expanding Minnesota's valuable energy efficiency resources. Our energy efficiency resources are so valuable that the Midwest Independent System Operator, which operates in a region in the Midwest by its name, has been wanting to take our energy resources from us. And we've been protecting that very carefully because all ratepayers have been paying for those resources. But just so you know, there are people who are very, very interested in our energy efficiency resources. We're also strengthening our transmission resources in ways that haven't been done in decades, and we're glad to see that that effort has been happening. We're also protecting public health and the environment in a reasonable way. Deputy Commissioner is absolutely correct that no energy resource is free of warts. There's always a balance that needs to be looked at, but that is part of what gets looked at by the utilities, by the Commission, by the Office of Energy Security. So in short, we are building an energy system that's efficient, sustainable, and affordable. We've been hearing questions about how many jobs have been created by the next generation or from wind source or wind resources in recent years. We don't have a complete answer to that question, but we do have a start to that answer. The numbers we have today are the direct jobs that would be that have been created and are being created by large non-utility wind certificates of need. So this doesn't include the jobs from utility-owned resources. It doesn't include jobs from small wind resources. It doesn't include jobs from transmission that's needed to connect the wind from where it blows to where the energy is used. And it doesn't include any indirect jobs or induced jobs, those kinds of things. It's simply the jobs that are listed in the filings where independent power producers have said they want to build wind facilities. What we know is that since 2007, there have been at least 10 certificates of need filed for large wind projects. And according to the information in those certificates, certificate of need filings, there would be over 1,000 short-term construction jobs to put the wind facilities in place. Further, there are over 100 full-time, long-term, full-time equivalent positions that are connected to the large wind projects. And a fair question is, what kind of jobs are those? Those kind of jobs are construction jobs, of course, engineering jobs, analytical and statistical jobs, jobs negotiating with turbine manufacturers, jobs managing the projects, finance jobs, and jobs to maintain the wind turbine facilities once they're in place. So it's a wide variety of jobs. Another question we've been asked about is Minnesota's resource mix, and we do have a handout for that. I don't know if the committee members have a copy of that handout. Yes, okay, thank you. We had to divide this up into two pictures. The first page that shows all of the resources shows that coal and nuclear are by far the dominant energy generation resources that Minnesotans are using. 60% of energy currently comes from coal resources, and 25% comes from nuclear resources. And because all the other resources are so small, they're kind of hard to look at down there, they're squished, we decided to show that on the second page, just looking at those squished down resources. What we see there is about 10% of energy is coming from wind, about 5% is coming from natural gas, about 1%, a little less than 1%, is coming from hydro, and the rest is coming from other kinds of resources. And we thought it'd be helpful for you to have this information so you can think about that as you discuss these issues. So those were the main background information that I wanted to provide, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Members, any more questions? Seeing none, thank you. And we will call Barbara Fries up.
I'm sorry.
Is Barbara Fries here? Please come on down. Identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee, and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Fries. I'm with the Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm a senior policy analyst, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in opposition to House File 72. Let me start by stressing why the provisions of the existing law are still so important. coal plants are the nation's and Minnesota's largest source of the carbon dioxide that is threatening our climate. Indeed, the nation's coal plants altogether emit more CO2 than all modes of surface transportation combined, more than all of our cars and trucks and trains and buses, etc. A single coal plant can emit more CO2 than hundreds of thousands of cars. And because coal plants last for decades, those emissions continue for decades. I am not myself a scientist, but I represent a science-based organization. So let me please take a moment to address the science. In the year 2009, the National Academy of Sciences said, and I quote, "The need for urgent action to address climate change is now indisputable." It is rare that scientists, who are a cautious bunch by nature, speak this forcefully and this clearly. But over the years, the National Academy has made this point over and over, as have the other leading scientific associations in this country and around the world. I know that not all the members of this committee agree with the National Academy on this question of science, but it is very important that you are aware of these warnings, because Minnesota cannot afford to ignore them. The need to cut our carbon emissions has in no way diminished since this law was passed in 2007, on the contrary. Of course, the provisions that House File 72 would repeal do not actually reduce our carbon emissions. They were put in place as anti-backsliding provisions, essentially to prevent us from taking major steps in the wrong direction. And when it comes to protecting the climate, the biggest and most irreversible step in the wrong direction that you can take would be by building a new coal plant. Let me also stress, by the way, that to the extent that any plant actually sequesters its carbon dioxide, and you heard this from some of the earlier witnesses as well, those tons are excluded from the scope of the law. So the existing provisions do not inhibit the development of this technology. On the contrary, they create an incentive to pursue it. On the question of the costs of the existing law, it is very important to recognize that this law is not preventing Minnesotans from pursuing attractive new coal plants, economically attractive new coal plants, simply because the costs of those plants have now risen so dramatically. In fact, new coal plants are now so expensive that they cannot compete with other cleaner options, and that's why over the last few years, most of the coal plant proposals around the country have been canceled or rejected by regulators. That includes, of course, the Big Stone 2 power plant in our own backyard, which was canceled by its backers, not because of this law from which it was explicitly excluded, but because the financial risks of such a costly project were too high. And those risks are very vividly demonstrated by the findings and data and projections of the Federal Energy Information Administration. The Federal EIA has a detailed computer model, and they put into it all of the cost information about the various energy alternatives and the demand requirements, and that model then helps project what utilities will be building in the decades ahead based on what it perceives to be the most economic alternatives. As recently as 2006, the EIA was projecting that nationwide, by the year 2030, we would see the construction of hundreds of new coal plants. That was 2006. Now in 2005, that same model with updated cost information no longer projects the construction of any new coal plants in the country, with two exceptions, that is, plants already under construction, which this law would not apply to, and plants employing carbon capture and storage technology, taking advantage of some existing federal subsidies. And again, any tons of CO2 that are stored would not be subject to the existing law. And the reason all these new coal plants have disappeared are because of the skyrocketing costs that new coal plants face. Again, back in 2006, EIA projected that the power from a new coal plant would cost 5.3 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, in 2011, it projects that power from a new coal plant has the cost of that power would be 11.8 cents per kilowatt hour. Cost projections have more than doubled. This is, would be for a coal plant that would come online in 2015, which is about as soon as you could get a coal plant online if you're just starting to propose it now. By way of comparison, energy from new wind projects coming online over the past few years, and now I'm switching time periods here, but I still think this is a valid comparison. Power from new wind projects have on average sold for about 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, or less than half the projected price of power from new coal plants. And as another point of comparison, the average retail price of electricity in Minnesota, according to the federal data that I looked at, was 7.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So at 11.8 cents, the wholesale cost of new coal power would be about 50% higher than the retail price that Minnesotans pay today. And there's an important point here I want to stress. This 11.8 cent cost of power from new coal plants does not include the cost of a future price on carbon. When you apply that kind of a price, and that's still widely expected despite the fact that it did not pass in the last Congress, then obviously those costs would go up even further. These numbers also do not reflect the potential that the price of coal itself could rise dramatically in response to various factors, including the upward pressure from international global demand. That demand caused spot coal prices in the eastern part of the United States to nearly triple in 2008. They came back down again with the economic slowdown, but they are now starting to go up again. Let me also just note that, of course, Minnesota doesn't have any of its own coal, and in order to buy the coal and import it into the state, it spends about $500 million a year. To the extent that it could devote that money to energy efficiency or our own ample renewable energy resources, those are dollars that could be kept here in Minnesota's economy. So essentially, the provisions of the existing law, while they were put in place to prevent pollution increases, have also had the effect of protecting Minnesota ratepayers and Minnesota's economy. And Mr. Chair, that's all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rees. Any questions, members? Not, we'll have Jenny Myers come up from the Isaac Walton League. If I'm seeing her anywhere here. Well, if not, members, any other questions? Otherwise, we do have an amendment. Representative Athens, do you want to
I'll offer
the A2 amendment.
I thought it was A5, Mr. Chair.
A5, sorry.
And Mr. Chair, rather than pass out a bunch of handouts in support of the amendment that would maybe take 15 minutes or so to go through, I had, and I got Chris, who's got a copy of it. I put it on a CD. It's 3 minutes, I think, or 3 minutes and 19 seconds. And as he's setting that up, what the point of this amendment, what it does is it would just put off the effective date of this bill until 2015 or until Congress acts. And I the fact is on this sort of topic, even guys like me that were initially pretty skeptical can change their minds. Smart people, people that we respect, can change their minds with time and with additional evidence. And I think it was Mr. Olson, I know it was Mr. Olson from Great River Energy, and I quote him at 3:02 p.m. today. He said this is a national issue that should be handled at a national level. So what the amendment does is it would keep the current law in place that Governor Plenty spearheaded that was passed with an overwhelming amount of support. Until a little bit more time passes, we give Congress an opportunity to take some action. If we don't agree with it, we can do whatever we may have within our power to do. But with that, lead in, Chris, are you ready to? Okay.
I like it so far.
It's very impressive. You like the background.
Thank you. proposition if we do it right.
You know, if you aim low, you get low. If you aim high, you might hit it.
We actually grow our economy through making these changes.
I'm Janet Napolitano, Democratic Governor of Arizona.
And I'm Tim Pawlenty, Republican Governor of Minnesota. We don't always share the same views,
but we both agree it's time for Congress to deal with the real threat of climate change.
If we act now, we can create thousands of new jobs in clean energy industries before our overseas competitors beat us to it.
If we wait even 2 years to act, we will need to cut our emissions twice as fast just to achieve the same results.
So come on, Congress, let's get moving.
In state after state, we're taking action. Now it's Congress's turn.
Cap greenhouse gas pollution now.
As to global warming, I think global warming definitely exists. And so we have to take steps to control greenhouse emissions and carbon emissions and the like.
We believe, as you'll see in just a moment, that there's going to be an entire new economic sector that is going to be opening up across this country, relating to clean and green jobs. As I think most of you in the room know, Minnesota has been a leader in renewable energy initiatives for many years. In 2007 legislative session, the legislature passed on a bipartisan basis our proposal to create a renewable energy standard and goal in Minnesota that's put into law. But Minnesota has been setting the pace for the country in terms of advancements in renewable and clean energy development. But
we're a nation that's held hostage to an outdated energy policy. We have an unbelievable and unhealthy amount of our economic future hooked to fossil fuels. I hope I can come back to this group in a couple of years and report back to you that we have dramatically increased our renewable energy in Minnesota, that we have dramatically reduced our reliance on electricity and energy sources through conservation and efficiency, and that we have a new carbon emission control program in place.
I don't think many people would disagree with the fact that what we're doing is unsustainable environmentally, economically, and from a national security standpoint. But we have a chance to try to make a difference and to do good. When we say things like we want to have 25% of our energy from renewable sources by the year 2025, that's a goal or a strategy, but you also have to make sure that those goals are realized. And that's what we're working on as we speak.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Governor Pawlenty, he's changed his mind, right? I mean, it's clear he was the strongest proponent in Minnesota in 2006-2007 for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Now he is, I believe, one of the strongest opponents of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And if I'm wrong, correct me, but I think that's fairly correct. I saw him on the Sunday morning show recently. And he
Mr.
talked
Chair.
About not knowing the source any longer.
Representative Anderson.
But
well, I thought we were on the bill. Are we talking about Governor Pawlenty, who is no longer our governor,
on the amendment.
Or are we going to talk about the amendment that you have?
That's
Representative Anderson.
The point is, when you look at the amendment, it puts off the repeal of this law for a couple of years, because even people that we respect, again, you know, and you can take this in a negative way if you want to, but there's nobody that has been more of a leader on this issue, frankly, on both sides now, than Governor Pawlenty. He's changed his mind. What I'm suspecting is that even folks that doubt the greenhouse gas emission issue that we face now, and we've got Lord Monckton and others that travel around talking about the holes in the climate change theory, is that, and if you look at, then you've got the University of St. Thomas professor, and all sorts of people that debunk Lord Monckton and others who debunked or tried to debunk the global warming theories. The point is that this is a developing situation that we have. Even people that we respect can change their minds apparently very rapidly. the point, so the message here is rather than repeal a law that I think 2 years from now we're probably going to want to pass again, let's hold off. We can pass it as Representative Bill or as Representative Beard wants to, but not put it into effect until 2015. Give it a little time. There may be further developments. My sense is that what we're going to get is the Academy of Sciences. These folks aren't, they don't come to these things without great care. Is that eventually people are going to come around to that line of thinking. If they don't, they don't, and we've got the law that goes into effect in 2015. But what's the rush at this point so that we can change our minds again? So with that, I would appreciate support for the amendment. I think it makes sense to hold off on repealing the law, at least until we give Congress an opportunity to act and until we give ourselves a little opportunity to get further information.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 200,000 unemployed Minnesotans are finding it difficult to wait while people in ivory towers are debating just how severe the global warming situation is. Let me just shed a couple of, and I'm going to ask for a little latitude here because I'm going to speak to the amendment and why I would encourage you to vote no, but I got to lay a little base, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief. I have a quote that I copied from a letter that I could not get for all of you. It is from Governor Pawlenty to the chairs of the House and Senate Energy Committee during conference committee process in 2007 when the next gen bill was being conferenced. This language threatens the reliability and cost competitiveness of the state energy supply by placing a moratorium on nearly all new major transmission facilities and generation facilities. Speaking specifically of the coal moratorium, which was not his desire. He was looking for the, and some of us argued vociferously with him over the 25 by 25, oh, by the way, it's 30 by 20 for the metropolitan area, for the greenhouse gas reduction targets, 15% by 2015, I think. We've got to be down from 2005 levels. There's several things in that bill that we could be debating here today. They probably belong in the Energy or the Environment Committee. But I'm talking about the commerce part now. And I want to be very clear, as much as I disagreed with Governor Pawlenty and as green as he was trying to be, this was the letter he sent to the conference committee members saying, please don't put this part in here. And it gets to the point that the previous occupant of the Office of Energy Security was trying strenuously to make over the past couple of years. It's amazing how an election can flip an office 180 degrees, isn't it? The point being that renewables have their place as they're trying to find their place in the generation mix, as they're trying to find the place where their technology fits so that we don't have to worry about our refrigerators shutting off when the wind doesn't blow or the lights going out at night when the sun's not shining. We need baseload power. We need a reliable grid, and this was the point the governor was trying to make. Keep the state strong and healthy. Keep the power abundant and affordable while we go on this renewable energy, clean energy thing. That's the point of what the governor was trying to do. That was before the Great Recession hit. And now we've got hundreds of thousands of people out of work. We've got a tax base that's shrinking. And I want to reference two handouts that I gave you. One is this one. It should be in your packets. This is what power plants pay cities, counties, and school districts, member. This is not what windmills pay or solar installations pay. This is what real prosperity pays to people that actually have these facilities in their jurisdictions. The second one, well, you can refer to the other one, which has to do with recessions and growth. We're in a recessionary period now. Yes, we have capacity now. It takes time to build these things. We'll be coming out of a recession. I would argue that that alone argues against adopting the A5 amendment. Mr. Chairman, if you cut me just a little more slack, I want to refer to this marvelous sheet that Mr. Grant just handed out from the new OES department, and refers specifically to the second page, which shows a large divergence between gas and wind. And I would like to point out that you'll notice there that the gas, which, oh, by the way, is never counted in the hourly cost of wind, it's a different generation. It's backup and it's intermediate. It's never counted in the cost of wind. But since we've had a recession, look at what has happened to our gas use. The first thing the utilities turn off is not nukes and coal. That's baseload power. That's real stuff. That's cheap stuff. That's 2 cents an hour or less, regardless of what the Union of Concerned Scientists say. The gas is the first thing they turn off because it's the most expensive to run. Look at the wind. It's going out of sight. You know why that is? Because it's a good deal? No. Because we mandated that the first thing the utilities have to buy is the wind when it blows. Whether they need it or not, they have to buy the wind, which means they turn off their gas and they start dialing back their baseload plans, which has a whole other set of ramifications. Members, there's a lot to discuss about this bill. It's a very complex and complicated procedure. The whole business of energy is. Some of you served on this committee with me in years past. You know how it is. But I'm asking you respectfully to decline the A5 amendment and support House File 72 unamended.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the amendment and to a comment regarding the handout Minnesota Conventional Fuel Plant Property Tax Benefit. I'm concerned about ratepayers, and I'm concerned about rates that are in greater Minnesota are really becoming alarming. But is it accurate to say that the property tax is paid by these six conventional fuel producers are actually taxes paid by the ratepayers? Every monthly bill that a ratepayer gets reflects property taxes that are paid by the generator. Is that right?
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anzels, my understanding is that taxes are built into the rate base and are recoverable from the ratepayers. That's exactly right. These happen to be XL rates you're looking at. It's very similar, although I did not ask for Minnesota Power or Otter Tail or who are the other UEIs, the one Interstate, Southeast. They're all pretty similar, but this is just an example of what kind of real estate taxes are paid to your local jurisdictions.
Yes, by ratepayers. By yes. Ratepayers.
Exactly.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question for the author of the amendment. Representative Adkins, the language is interesting. You said a couple of times that you wanted to wait and give the federal government an opportunity to pass some federal legislation on this. What strikes me in the amendment is the last part, which says whichever is later. So the way that I read that, both of these things would have to pass before this bill then would become law. So it wouldn't be just waiting for the federal government. If they act tomorrow, according to this amendment, the way I'm reading it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, we would still have to wait until January 1st of 2015. The other thing that I'm concerned about is if the federal government never acts because of that last language that says whichever is later, this would never become law. Is that correct?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Dowd. You got it. The point, by the way, and it was actually a quote from Governor Pawlenty to give Congress an opportunity to act, as well as from Mr. Olson from Grid River Energy. So they all talk about it being a national issue, and giving them an opportunity to act in a national fashion, I think, would make some sense. With that, and that's, what I tried to do is capture what they have been saying for years. If you would support it and have some different language, I'd be happy to entertain that. You're smiling, though, at this point. I'm gathering I'm not going to get your support, regardless of what the amendment says. I should say, if I might have a little bit of latitude relative to the question, the point, and I got the sense from Representative Anderson and perhaps others, that when we played some footage, and I could have passed out 20 handouts of Governor Pawlenty saying things, it took 3 minutes if you do it just from the video, was not to be offensive. And to the extent I offended anybody on the other side of the table or anybody in the room, I apologize for that. Very genuinely, I apologize for that. You're never offended, Representative Davis. But the point is that people that we respect very much have changed positions 180 degrees on this issue in a very rapid period of time, some for different reasons than others. But to now repeal what we passed just a couple of years ago, spearheaded by Governor Pawlenty, is nonsensical without at least giving it a little bit of time to see where this discussion leads. Otherwise, I fear what we're going to do, and that's the purpose of the amendment, is 2 years from now, folks, we're going to be back, we're going to pass something else. And people are going to look at us, and they're going to think, whether it was John Kerry who supported that thing before he opposed that thing, or whether it was Senator McCain, or whether it was Mark Dayton who supported something before he opposed something, or Joe Atkins. Let's give it a chance to work. That's the point of the amendment. With that, I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Other questions to the amendment, members? Seeing none, I think we've had some talk here about the ratepayers. I think we should protect the ratepayers and always keep our constituents, our citizens, and our ratepayers in mind. And I would encourage members to vote no on the amendment. Representative Beard, do you want to have a final word on the amendment? Or Representative Atkins on your amendment?
Nope. I think I made myself clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members to the A5 amendment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No. Nay.
Motion does not prevail. To the bill. We've had everybody that was on the list came down and testified. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify very briefly for or against the bill? Seeing none, members, any final questions for the author to the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question with regards to some of the coal plant technology, and I'm not sure exactly who to direct this to. There was a discussion, I think Mr. Grant was responding to a question from Representative Mullery, and maybe Mr. Olson, about the plant that they're building and kind of using current state-of-the-art clean coal technology. I wondered if he could expound on that a little bit, because from Mr. Grant's comments, what I took from that, and I hope he'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that injecting carbon dioxide into the ground really doesn't sound like it's kind of a on-the-market technology right now. And I wondered if somebody could clarify that for me.
We have someone coming down who looks like he can clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but it sounds like it relates to whether there's carbon capture and sequestration that will be happening at Spiritwood Station. The answer to that is no. That technology is not commercially available, and that technology is not installed at that plant.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, the article that Representative Mullery was referring to, I have read it. I'm sorry I don't have it in my packet, but I believe it was in southern Saskatchewan where they were taking the CO2 that's been captured out of a plant that's a little further west in North Dakota, one that we've been invited to see on the Energy Committee, by the way, and they're actually piping it to a depleted oil field and injecting it into the rock formations, forcing oil back up out of the it's enhanced recovery technique. Apparently, there's some question about whether or not some cows that basically suffocated, asphyxiated, because CO2 is heavier than the regular atmosphere, so it tends to lay in low depressions. The feeling is there may have been a fissure where some of that leaked up out of the ground, and some cows in a paddock apparently asphyxiated from the CO2. That's the story as I remember it. Representative Mullery can correct me if he's wrong, but I can't cite the source, and so I wasn't going to bring it up today until somebody asked the question.
Representative Loon, did that get your question answered?
Well, that helps, Mr. Chairman, and I guess what I'm... So am I hearing that that's not necessarily a technology that is really available or widely used?
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, it's out there, and this is a long discussion. If you thought Representative Atkins' first question was long, this could be an hour of fascinating discussion about what happens when and how things can be captured and so on and so forth. But I guess the short answer would be, in theory, there are ways to do this. In practicality, it's proving to be very difficult, very expensive, yes.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I was going to say I believe that there's a plant, and I thought it was open now in Indiana that was doing that exact. But I think Representative Beard is correct. It's quite a mess. But it's a lot more than just the one in Saskatchewan. There's some, I believe, some problems elsewhere in the world, but it would take a long time.
Representative Beard.
I've just been told we do have an expert in carbon capture technology in the audience. If you'd like to hear a moment of discussion about that, I'd be happy to ask him to come down.
We're getting a little far afield from where we want to be on the bill, and we're starting to run short of time. If members are concerned, we can hear very brief comments on that, but we are not the Energy Committee. We're the Commerce Committee, and we need to get out of here in the next 10 minutes. So if there's anyone that feels strongly about wanting to hear that, we can do it. Otherwise, we can ask after the hearing. Members can hear as much as they'd like. Representative Mullery, did that get your question answered?
Mr. Chairman, I think as much as we would get in even an hour, probably.
Excellent. Any other questions, members? If not, Representative Beard will give you the final word on your bill.
Members, thank you for a good discussion about this bill. We had almost 4 hours of testimony in the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. This, though, I was more concerned about the impacts on commerce, on keeping our state competitive and on the cutting edge. And to address just a few comments that were made about the cost, the lowest cost alternative. If you're interested, I have a website that comes from the United States Energy Information Administration. Their annual energy outlook from December of last year is actually what we call a system levelized cost, which is the way you have to add up the cost of power. In all of these situations, except for conventional gas, coal, clean coal with the newest technology, is still the lowest cost alternative out there. Wind, whenever you actually have to roll in the cost of transmission and gas backup, is half again as much as conventional coal. Members, this is about keeping Minnesota in play. It's also, I think, about good governance. Some of you know that we have a gag rule on the Dan Patch line, a little bill I'm carrying, not because I support putting a commuter rail on Dan Patch, but because not allowing intelligent and responsible people to even consider things for moving forward in the future, I think, is just poor governance. In this case, we've pretty much got a virtual gag rule on the industry. The reason there are no plans for coal-fired power plants going forward is because we've told them, you can't do it. So I guess we're not surprised that they're following the law. Please help us move Minnesota's energy back to a balanced position that will allow renewables to actually have a fighting chance to make it in the marketplace by removing the virtual coal moratorium and supporting House File 72. Thank you, members.
With that, Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 72 be passed. Oh, that's right. We are laying it over. We're voting on this
Tuesday.
We're voting on this next week. So, members, we are at this point going to lay the bill over. And with nothing else before us, we are adjourned for the day.